better, lower emitting, better performing product on the marketplace today than ever before. And part of the ability to get that product to the marketplace has been a change in fuels. It's been recognized by the petroleum industry, who were supportive of the federal requirement for low sulfur diesel fuel. It's been supported by EPA. It was mandated by Congress. I understand that Alaska is in a very different position than the other states in the union, and particularly the lower 48 states. And I listened already carefully this morning to some of the testimony and comments of members of the committee. My members are very sensitive to the economic impacts of low sulfur diesel fuel in Alaska. I think it's just important for the members of the committee to understand that engine manufacturers have no choice in this matter. They're absolutely mandated by the federal government as to the types of engines that they can sell and the emissions performance characteristics of those engines. And if those engines are operated on other than low sulfur diesel fuel, there will be performance ramifications. That none of this is in our control. And it's important only that you understand that, and that the citizens of California recognize that those engines, if operating on high sulfur fuel, won't just get somewhat poorer durability, somewhat higher maintenance costs, certainly higher emissions, but in fact could not perform their function, which is to move goods and people from point A to point B.
One follow-up, if I may.
Representative Ryan with a follow-up.
Well, the standard rule, we've had internal combustion engines around for pretty close to 100 years. Standard rule of thumb for people that operate them is fuel consumption is generally a half a pound per horsepower per hour. And it's been a long time, and nobody's been able to really improve on that. Have you folks figured out a way, a new and inventive way, or are we talking about a little bit more fuel consumption to achieve the same end as far as power generation is concerned versus particulate matter?
I'm not sure that I'm in the best position technically to respond to your comment, other than to say this, that, again, if we simply looked at the fuel economy levels of an over-the-road truck over the last, say, 10 years, the fuel economy has improved. It has improved fairly substantially. I think it is anticipated with these newer emission standards that are coming in place that fuel economy will suffer as a result. There is a natural trade-off in a diesel engine between reducing NOx emissions and fuel economy or the amount of fuel that's burned. So we expect there to be some negative impact, but that's not the only issue that we're raising by any means. Not just that these engines will burn more fuel, it is that the parts will wear faster, the durability of the engine will decrease, and more importantly, the nature of these emission control systems are such that they will plug or be poisoned as a result of seeing sulfur levels and higher sulfur levels in the fuel, such that the engine itself perhaps won't function.
Mr. Mandel, I would like to bring up, you mentioned that our emissions will impact Canada. Do you know that we only have one two-lane road that connects Alaska with Canada? And I don't know if you heard the earlier testimony, but the EPA is not concerned with the emissions that we have in the particulate because of the low density of transportation that we have here. And so it would seem to me that the main contention that we're talking about here is the catastrophic damage or possible catastrophic damage to your new generation of engines that you represent. Are you going to say at this point that every engine will fail with the regular diesel, or are there going to be instances where some of those engines will continue to putter right along?
Based on the best information that I have to present to the committee today, any engine that's meeting these new advanced emission standards with advanced catalyst technology or EGR systems, and I think you've got EPA who has has talked to my members on a confidential basis to find out their product plans. There will be a substantial usage of those kinds of technologies. I don't want to overrepresent to members of the committee that every single engine will have those technologies, but we are talking about a substantial percentage, perhaps all, that will, and the data shows that those technologies in those engines, when operated on high sulfur fuel, will, across the board, suffer excess costs, maintenance problems, durability problems, plugging, poisoning, et cetera.
And that would be over the life of the engine and not necessarily instantaneous. Let me ask this question. Are we looking at a useful life of a diesel engine at 10,000 hours dropping down to 6,000 hours with the advent of the diesel, the regular diesel instead of low sulfur?
In part, the answer to your question depends a little bit on the choice of technology that a particular engine or engine manufacturer might employ to meet EPA stringent standards. For some technologies, there may not be that catastrophic failure where the vehicle ends up being parked by the side of the road, but there will be a loss of durability. The engine won't last as long, or it will have to be maintained more frequently at a higher cost. I cannot represent to you what percentage of life is lost or what percentage increase of maintenance there will be today. But what I do also want you to be aware of is that for some technologies in EGR, lean NOx, low NOx catalysts are another example. The data show that a single exposure to high sulfur fuel can irreversibly damage that engine. So that we are not just talking about an over the life of the product type of problem, but sort of an instantaneous one time only problem, which again raises this issue that that Laurie Stewart talked to you about, that I tried to mention in my prepared comments, that truckers from outside the state delivering goods into Alaska are going to have problems if they have only high sulfur fuel to fill up on to get back out of the state.
Can you imagine that there might be somebody that will import smaller quantities of low sulfur diesels to fit that niche market?
I really can't speak to that. You all have a much better knowledge about the infrastructure in Alaska that would support that. I just can't comment. I would hope that given the problems that unfortunately we're presenting to you today, we would be able to find some way to assure that those vehicles that need the low sulfur fuel will get the low sulfur fuel.
And I believe that we will have entrepreneurs that will supply low sulfur fuel without mandating to everybody in the state that they must use a low sulfur fuel, whether they need it or not. And my contention is that if we get the exemption, that we will be operating with low sulfur diesel up here. It just will not be forced down the throats of the folks that do not need it or want it, and they will make that decision themselves. I will contend that we will have low sulfur diesel available for the out-of-state motorists, for the people that want it, and they will pay the extra price for it, and they will make the decision whether they want to have less life in their engine or if they want to spend more money for fuel. And that will be the decision that they make, and I can almost guarantee you that there will be low sulfur diesel in the state of Alaska, but I don't want it a mandatory for everybody that does not need it or does not want it. And this is the crux of the testimony that I think would like to see come out today. Do you have any problem with that concept, Mr. Mandel? If we can supply low sulfur diesel, should we mandate it for everybody?
I don't have a disagreement that only those people who need it should use it. I must say I do have some concerns that where people need it, that they would still have choice as to whether to use it or not. We're well aware, my members are well aware of the commercial nature of this business, and the price of a gallon of diesel fuel is a very strong motivator to whether someone does well in business or even can stay in business. And so, I want to start by saying we have an enormous sensitivity to that. But that also creates a problem if a individual operator has the choice of, you know, buying a dollar and a half a gallon or $2 a gallon or a dollar a gallon or whatever it might be for diesel fuel, not recognizing what harm a single gallon of high sulfur fuel will do to the engine. It may not be just a question of their accepting a little less durability. It may be a question, again, where they don't recognize it, that the engine will fail on them, or that engine back in Canada or in the lower 48 states will fail an inspection and maintenance program, creating potential liability for either the ultimate owner of the engine, the trucking firm, or the engine manufacturer under warranty. So there are some problems to not to providing a sort of a choice in the marketplace where the engine really can't abide by that choice. Because of the rules that we are forced to operate under, EPA's emission standards that drive this whole process, those engines only should operate on low sulfur fuel. And again, if there are other products in the state that don't need it, that distinction I recognize, and we certainly have no quibble over.
Well, Mr. Mandel, I don't mean to stay so long with you, but you are the only, you are the person or the reason that we're having this hearing today, and I want to explore virtually everything on this. It seems to be that you hold a lot of sway with the EPA as to whether we get an exemption or not, and my apologies for stumbling along on this, but I am very concerned on mandating for everybody. In the scenario that I brought forward, in layman's terms, would you agree that that might be the best way to do it, to have low sulfur diesel available but not mandated for everybody, and let the user determine? And believe me, we do have truck drivers that are sophisticated enough to understand low sulfur diesel and regular diesel if they have a EGR in their system. And so what I guess I would like for you to say, if you can, that there you don't really have a problem with our exemption if we have low sulfur diesel available for users that choose that.
I guess I realize that the question you're wanting me to answer, I cannot agree with it the way you put it. I certainly, for off-road vehicles, stationary engines, farm construction equipment, there's no need to have high sulfur fuel. That's not the requirement. Low sulfur fuel. That's not the requirement. While it is the requirement to have low sulfur fuel for other on-highway engines, I recognize that today's technologies and older technologies won't fail if they see higher sulfur fuel. And in that regard, I would agree that there would not be a need to mandate or force the use of fuels there. But with the new technologies coming as soon as 2002 and across the board in 2004, I can't agree with you that it should be the user's choice as to whether to operate on that fuel or not. I don't think that makes sense because the engines will suffer as a result. The vehicles will suffer. And in fact, again, there could be complete failure. As well as, and it's not my principal motivation here, but as well as liability, potential liability for either the fleet operator, the owner, which could be the state, or the engine manufacturer. So I'm trying to respond to your question by agreeing with you in part that it doesn't have to be an across-the-board mandate, but for the newer technologies, there shouldn't be a choice.
So that is an agreement that you would work on. You would say that you don't, there should be an exemption for the existing diesels we have now, and there should be availability of the low sulfur diesel for the new technology. And I'm not suggesting that they have a choice, but they have the ability to buy the low sulfur diesel. Representative Ryan, you had a question.
Well, I'm not sure if you're a lot of folks who haven't been in Alaska and lived here don't quite understand it. We have a population of some 600,000 people over an area half as big as the lower 48, and there's niche industries up here that are very important, and people come along from Washington, D.C. with broad sweeping mandates that are not particular. We've heard testimony earlier that these fuel dyes make the fuels unsuitable for aircraft use, and because of the Great Circle navigation route, our international airport in Anchorage is a gateway to the Pacific Rim, and what happens there is very important to not only the people in Anchorage, but to the state of Alaska, for the economic growth and development that comes out of that. And if we are going to have a problem with fuels that are unacceptable to airlines and driving up the cost, the fuel in the airline business is an exceedingly competitive situation. You're talking about parts of a penny per gallon, determining whether you're going to have people come or not and use your facilities. And you guys are talking a five to a quarter like there's nothing to it. And I can guarantee you 5 cents to 25 cents in the airline business, we're not going to have any aircraft companies, carriers coming in if we're looking at those kind of costs. You know, we have a thing up here, little bumper stickers. We don't care how they do it outside because we have a unique situation here. We live in a subarctic and an arctic condition, and the things that are applicable to the lower 48 a lot of times are foolishness here. And this is one of the reasons why we're trying to express these concerns. I can understand your organization's mandates and doing the best they can to try to meet them, but you have to understand that we are in an entirely different situation. We need some flexibility on your part and a little understanding. Perhaps if some representatives of your organization could come up here and experience the climatological changes and just fly over the country and take a look at it, you'd see that perhaps a lot of the things that you're interested in aren't really applicable and that we do need to make an agreement.
First of all, I want to represent to all of you that on behalf of VMA and my members, we are very much interested in working with the state and with EPA to address what we see as a important and challenging issue. But I think to the degree that you put this in our lap, that this is a problem of our creation, you're misunderstanding the dynamic. EPA, by law, by the Clean Air Act, it starts with Congress, requires engine manufacturers to meet certain standards. We have no choice in that matter. We are told exactly what those standards are. And I am simply reporting to you what the results will be of those products, which are the only kind of products that can be sold in the United States, once operated on higher sulfur fuel, what the results will be. You all make the policy decisions. Obviously, EPA has a policy decision to make here, and we will live by it. But I simply think you need to know what the constraints are on the engine manufacturer. We don't make the rules.
Mr. Mandel, is your standards longevity of the engine life, or is your standards that you're referring to for the EPA, that the emissions and the particulate?
It's the emissions and the particulate, which, by the way, do have a longevity element to it. There is what's called the useful life, which is how long the engine must meet those standards. So it's part of EPA's requirements, both the actual limit and the time period.
So if EPA is not concerned about the emissions and particulates, why are you?
No, I think you're missing the point. I apologize if I'm not making myself clear enough. When the engine is sold, it has to meet EPA's emission standards. To do that, there are certain technologies that must be on the engine. They cannot legally be removed. They cannot, in some cases, physically be removed. That product is the only product that can be sold in Alaska. I'm so used to thinking of California being the different state when I talk about environmental regulations.
We run into that trouble all the time. People think we're California.
I don't. But I apologize for misspeaking. But that's the only engine that legally can be sold in Alaska. All I'm telling you is what the implications will be from operating that engine on higher sulfur fuel.
Well, I appreciate that, but did you not hear earlier when the EPA said they were not concerned with the amount of particulate and emissions?
But EPA also said they had no ability to change the requirements for what we could sell.
They would give us an exemption up here. Why wouldn't you?
We don't have the ability. If it were up to us, we would do whatever we could. We don't have that freedom. I would appreciate, Ms. Stewart or Mr. Mashili, perhaps commenting from EPA's perspective. We must sell a product that meets the EPA requirement. That is our only choice. Whether or not it meets the emission standards when operating on your fuel is an EPA and Alaska problem. I'm merely pointing out that it won't. But that's not the issue. That hardware will be on the engine.
Go ahead, Ms. Stewart.
Yes, I would confirm that. Just what Paul Mashili said earlier, we don't have the same exemption provision under engine standards for the diesel sulfur, so we really have no mechanism to exempt Alaska from engine standards. The diesel sulfur exemption provision was directly tied to that fuel control.
I'm not sure that Alaska wants an engine standard set aside. I think what we're looking at is the emissions, whether they're severe enough that we need to mandate the low sulfur diesel, then that's the argument. If they're not, which everybody seems to testify this morning that the emissions are not a problem, then this whole concern is whether the longevity of the engine works or not, and I don't believe that the reduced longevity of the engine is that big of a concern when you factor in the amount of existing grandfathered diesels that we have in this state and the cost of converting. If we have an emission problem and a particulate problem, then we need to talk on that line. But apparently we don't, because of the low usage that we have with the mobile engines and stationary engines. What I would suggest is that we're talking simply on the longevity portion of the engines, and I don't believe that that's the concern of EPA or the engine manufacturers in this case. We're talking about an exemption for emissions and particulate, and I think we should continue talking about that. The longevity situation, trust me, if there is a demand for low sulfur diesel because of these new engines, and there will be people that will put in the tanks. They will be people that will offer that service. We are very sophisticated up here. We know how to do that. However, to mandate that everybody in the state has to go to a low sulfur diesel just to appease Mr. Mandel and his engine manufacturing association is unnecessarily and extremely cruel to folks that don't have the money to make that conversion. And that is my contention, and that is the legislature's contention at this point, that we are extremely interested in protecting the citizens of this state from something that is mandated that will only affect a very small portion of the state that can be easily dealt with by the free enterprise method. We still have that in Alaska.
Well, I would just want to emphasize that we are not doing this just to respond to the engine manufacturers' concerns, but we've had that independently validated by our own engine experts that this is a concern for the new technology. It has become a concern, I think, a little sooner than we believed it necessarily would because of the 2002 time frame. It's becoming very clear we are going to have new vehicles in that time frame, and we really cannot, this is not an issue we can just ignore and with the permanent exemption. I think EPA would be called to the carpet later on if we had significant engine problems. It's something that EPA can only, it's only responsible that EPA consider this as a significant factor in the decision. And I think we'd be considered irresponsible in the future if we do have engine problems as a result of a permanent exemption.
Would there be a possibility with the unleaded fuel, and when somebody fuels up their vehicle, it says unleaded fuel only, and the nozzle is a little bit smaller where you can't insert the regular nozzle in there, would that be a logical way of doing it with a low sulfur diesel to where individuals could not physically put the regular diesel in? And wouldn't that be a much easier and better way to attack this problem rather than just blanket mandates?
Right. I guess that would really be an issue for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, or in terms of what the costs of a program like that in Alaska would be. I don't know whether we'd still have the leeway under those circumstances to grant the exemption. We'd have to compare the economic cost of doing that to the economic cost of having low sulfur statewide, and there may not be a significant cost saving. I think we'd have to see how the numbers came out on something like that.
Well, let's take a look at the numbers then, and let's move on to some of the other folks that will present us with some of those numbers. And if we can, if it's going to cost us $100 million to change over to low sulfur diesel, and it's only going to cost us $10 million to fit little nozzles on the tanks, I certainly know where I'm going to suggest we go.
Because, I mean, our understanding is, and unless this isn't true, that the segregation tanks are not available for low sulfur, and that's part of the basis of the cost estimate. So if those separate tanks are available on a widespread enough basis to have a separate fuel source, then I think we would question whether the cost really, you know, is that significant to have low sulfur available.
Well, the fuel source would be utilized along the highway system where the new diesels would get to, and we could easily, that would not be the cost. The cost is when we have to outfit the bush areas with the dual tankage. And obviously, if those people bring in the new technology and the new engines, they order the fuel. There's a tremendous amount of fuel that is ordered up by barge from the lower 48 that comes into Alaska in the form of 55-gallon drums, and they would simply order the low sulfur diesel at that time if that's the technology that they had. I would hope that you guys have listened with an open mind as to some of our problems up here and the solutions. It's my understanding, Mr. Mandel, if you would very quickly sum up, and I will help you with this, that your situation is that, do you want a permanent exemption in Alaska, yes or no?
We don't want a permanent exemption because it won't allow the engines to meet our customers' demands.
So you do not want a permanent exemption regardless of the fact that the particulate and the emissions is not the question here?
Correct.
Thank you. Let's move on to Alaska Truckers Association, Mr. Frank Dillon.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jed Mandel again. Just because I don't want to not do what you're expecting, I can only be on this call for about another half hour or so. Would you like me to stay on? Are you expecting me to be on longer?
Please do, if you would. And then why don't you notify me? You're going to be on until 10:30, is that right?
Correct.
Our time? Okay, correct. I will maybe visit with you again at maybe 10:25.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And thank you, members of the committee.
Yes. Mr. Dillon, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Frank Dillon. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Alaska Trucking Association, which is a 39-year-old trade association representing commercial vehicle users throughout the state with members from Annette to Dutch Harbor to Prudhoe Bay to Tok. So we pretty much geographically and physically through our membership represent people who use diesel engines and transport virtually every sort of commodity, whether it be consumable or natural resource commodity, in the state. We've been involved in the low sulfur issue as an association since 1991, when we became aware that this was a potential problem. We'll take the credit for actually alerting the state of Alaska to the situation and the possibility of getting the exemption. And we worked very hard in the early years to get an exemption for the state of Alaska, simply based on the cost benefit of what we perceived at that time to be the information available, and that cost benefit relationship showed that there was absolutely a compelling necessity for the exemption and virtually no reason at all for us to go to low sulfur fuel for the purposes of air quality or environmental quality issues. The task force that was formed and spoken about earlier met several times. There was some good stimulating discussion. There was a sensitivity to the environmental question, to the air quality question. But in fact, because we do represent such a small segment of the internal combustion engine emissions contribution to air quality degradation, that it just wasn't deemed to be of a particular importance. That's not to say that it is not of an importance to us what comes out of the exhaust stack of a diesel engine. I provided the committee today with some information that has been a combined effort of the part of the engine manufacturers, the trucking industry, and the EPA, showing that over the last decade we have made significant improvements in our in the reduction of our contribution to air quality problems. That is the industry in general. Specifically in Alaska, because of the nature of our industry, we have further been able to eliminate our contribution in terms of particulate matter and other exhaust problems, utilizing larger trucks to move more freight with fewer tractors. Very simple relationship. The doubles that were often complained about are pulled by a single tractor with a single admission point, as opposed to a set of two trailers pulled by two tractors, which would include, of course, correspondingly double the amount of emission. I do sympathize with the position the engine manufacturers are in, because the trucking industry finds itself in that position with the federal government quite frequently. They've been told, because of a law that's been passed in Congress that may or may not have been well thought through, that this is what they have to do. We were sensitive to this, and in 1994 had representatives from the major engine manufacturers, several of them, Caterpillar, Detroit, and Cummins, come to Alaska and told us at that time that although there could be some minor problems with durability, that they didn't foresee over the next decade any real problems with the ability to burn higher sulfur contents, considering what we have for a higher sulfur content fuel, which by many standards it would have been considered some time ago to have been a low sulfur fuel. At that point in time, again, we revoiced our position wanting the exception or the exemption to be granted with EPA. We're here today to continue with the insistence that the exemption be granted. We've listened to the testimony today, and we believe that there are a couple of different problems here that that can be addressed. For one thing, EPA may have to, within the allowance of the law, consider allowing changes to be made in the aftermarket for engines sold in Alaska so that we can burn higher diesel fuels. There's nothing that's going to happen overnight in the engine market. My guesstimation, I think it's a pretty good one, right now we probably have the majority of the diesel power that's moving freight in this state was put into service prior to 1993. So by the time the new standards come into effect, it's not a matter of us running out and buying a lot of new engines. We buy engines at a particular rate. There'll be people looking right now to decide when they're going to have to invest in engines, what the costs are going to be. If we cannot burn higher sulfur fuel, the market will find a way to put lower sulfur fuel in the trucks. It's as simple as that. I have to agree with the chairman on that particular issue. I'm a little bit concerned about what they're going to sell for engines in rural Alaska that basically will be diesel powered, and how they're going to burn the higher sulfur fuel that's likely to continue for the necessities of power generation, which definitely has a public safety interest. I think the initial statement that the Engine Manufacturers Association filed in their initial docket to EPA was a little bit disingenuous. It was a little bit inflammatory in its language, and perhaps done so specifically to try to raise a question of fear rather than one of reality. There won't be any carryover in terms of air quality degradation to Canada or to our neighboring states, or even to the Soviet or Russia, as a matter of fact. It's unlikely to see anything as a result of our emission problems. There are fleets operating in every metropolitan area, major metropolitan area of the lower 48, that are comprised of more Class 7 and Class 8 tractors than we have in the entire state of Alaska. However, that said, the trucking industry in Alaska still remains absolutely vital to everyone's standard of living and to the production of oil from Prudhoe Bay and right on down the line to the fact that we could not live here without diesel engines in trucks as we currently move the freight in the state. The cost distribution, we've looked at this and worked with the various refiners to try to find out what it would cost to take the sulfur out of the fuel in the state. And given that we are only 5% of that market, the cost of converting, as near as we can tell, would be substantial. The benefit in terms of air quality, very small, and therefore there didn't seem to be much of a reason to do it. However, with that said, if prior or post-year 2000 or 2002, we would be unable to buy an engine manufactured in America that would burn the higher sulfur fuel, that could be a problem. However, there are other engine manufacturers in the world who will be producing diesel engines. In fact, most of the diesel engines produced outside the United States will not be complying with the same standards, and that could perhaps be an option for powering mobile equipment in the state. We do have a problem with compatibility. We're not so concerned about our aftermarket problem. We don't sell many diesel or trucks back to the lower 48 once we've used them up here in Alaska. Generally, when we use them up, they're finished. And in fact, what we usually do is go down to places in the lower 48 and buy our fleets of equipment to use up here after those folks down south think they've actually used them up. We know we can fix them up and run them for a few more years. So I do think there's a lot of misunderstanding about the state of Alaska. And the bottom line on this, I think this is a much bigger, more universal struggle than whether we're going to see an exemption granted in the state or not. There is a multi-billion dollar distribution of dollars going on here that's going to be decided over the next few years in terms of air quality issues between those folks that are taking the fuel and burning it and those folks that are providing the fuel to be burned. We're kind of just a small player caught in the middle at a time when I think the profile of this issue can be raised, and I believe that that there are ways to accommodate the needs we have in Alaska and still have this exemption. When we say a permanent exemption, let's remember that we're not talking about something written on the stone tablets being carried down from the mountain here. I'm sure that the EPA would agree that the permanent exemption could be rescinded fairly easily, given a request from the state to do so, a request or a necessity in terms of air quality to do so. But that kind of laid out there, I would be happy to answer any questions or do what I can to help fill in any of the blanks.
Thank you, Mr. Dillon. I've got one question, and that's on the, is there maintenance that can happen to postpone the doomsday catastrophic engine failures that, that Mr. Mandel was?
Well, since these engines aren't in the market yet, basically we don't know. We're not sure. We have to somewhat take their word for the fact that they're not going to be able to burn the type of fuel that we're going to have available. On the other hand, these people are extremely innovative and in the past have found ways to provide specialized equipment for the operation in our Arctic environment, for example. There was a time when it was said that you couldn't run diesel engines in the kind of conditions that we commonly run them in now on the North Slope. There were times when people said you'll never get 5 miles to the gallon out of a diesel engine in a truck, and we get 6 and 7 commonly now. There's a great deal of innovative resourcefulness in the engine manufacturer's world, and I'm not so certain that with cooperation, and this would be essential from the EPA, the technological solutions that would provide for meeting certain of the air quality problems, and I say that in quotes, couldn't be solved through either aftermarket adjustments or actually manufacturing an engine that could be used for rural power generation and for diesel over-the-road power.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members and Mr. Dillon? With that, thank you, Mr. Dillon.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And again, just let me make sure I'm clear. We would like to see this exemption granted to the state of Alaska.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Mandel, I guess that didn't take as long as I thought it would. I would hope that, that we've shed some light, and I know that I keep directing this towards you, even though the EPA is going to make the decision, but the EPA has said that the Engine Manufacturers Association has carried a lot of weight on their decision, and I guess that's why I'm pursuing this the way that I am. I would certainly hope, Mr. Mandel, that you would think of the tremendous impact that is going to happen to Alaska to folks that don't necessarily need your protection, that will be severely impacted because of this financially. It'll be a very big burden on the bush and the rural areas. And I would certainly invite you to come to Alaska and to see the vast area that we have up here that there is nobody living in, that there is communities maybe of 30 to 200 to 300 folks in the midst of millions of acres of land. And I would certainly hope that while you might think of your neighborhood down there, that's simply not the case in Alaska. There are parts of Anchorage that are as densely populated as San Francisco or Chicago or New York or any of those bigger cities, and that is not the normal for the state. And we are very, very concerned about mandating things for folks that don't need to be mandated. Representative Ryan.
Just an observation. When we were building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, I was in charge of a maintenance facility. And some of the things we had to do to make diesel engines run in the 40, 60 below temperatures, we were very innovative. In fact, we developed a lot of this Arctic technology because we called the technical representatives from Caterpillar asking for how do we keep these engines at operating temperature. And the things they suggested we had tried a long time before, so we had to develop new ways to do it to maintain the engine life and efficiency to keep the equipment operating and perform the task. And the thing I'm trying to stress is we have very unique operating environments here, and it's very different. And this blanket policy that you folks are encouraging, I can understand from your perspective of the lower 48, but I don't know of any places in the lower 48 that are anywhere similar to the kind of climate and the environment in which we live.
With that, I'd like to move on. I certainly appreciate your attending this, Mr. Mandel, and that unless you have a quick wrap-up, I will move on to further testimony from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
My thanks for the opportunity, and it has been very instructive. I will take your comments back to my members, and if we can figure out a way to get out from under Congress's and EPA's legal requirements on us, I mean, obviously we're willing to work with everyone to do so.
Good, and I will, just as a side note, the people of Alaska own billions of dollars worth of stock in corporate America, and some of those millions of dollars, we have millions of dollars in some of your clients, and I will be glad to send you a list. We certainly appreciate their profitability and their fact for building America, and you will have to appreciate that we are a shareholder of some of your clients. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yes.
My name is Marilyn Crockett. I am the Assistant Executive Director for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AOGA is a trade association of 19 member companies who represent the majority of oil and gas exploration, production, transportation, refining, and marketing activities in the state. All of the in-state producers of oil and gas are members of AOGA, and the three in-state refiners are members of AOGA. The Clean Air Act allows EPA to permanently exempt areas from the 0.05% diesel requirement if the administrator finds that such a requirement is not feasible or is unreasonable due to, one, unique geographic, two, meteorological, and three, economic or other factors. EPA in its Federal Register notice earlier this year rightly concluded that these factors are applicable to the state. In talking about the geographical conditions of the state, I found a statistic that Representative Ryan presented of the number of miles of roads equivalent to what the lower 48 had in the 1800s was interesting. Alaska is the largest state in the Union, of course, covering 586,000 miles. There's four different climatic zones, and the state extends 2,700 miles from east to west and 1,400 miles north to south. The center of the state's population is in Anchorage, which is over 1,500 air or sea miles from Seattle. Alaska is only linked to the lower 48 via highway, of course, as the Alaska Highway, as all of us know. But without an appreciation of Alaska's size and remoteness from the rest of the United States, one can't truly understand the logistical problems associated with fuel manufacturing, transportation, and distribution. In a state with approximately one person per square mile, nearly half of whom are located in Anchorage, deep water ports, airfields, and other logistical support bases are few and far between. Alaska has only about 14,000 miles of road for its 586,000 square miles. By contrast, the nation's second largest state of Texas, has over 300,000 miles of road for its 267,000 square miles. Because of the great geographic extent, as I mentioned a moment ago, when we talk about the climatic conditions in the state of Alaska, Alaska is so large that it actually spans four general climatic zones, the maritime, the transitional, the continental, and the Arctic zones. In the maritime zones, which is limited to the extreme southern part of the state, long cold winters typify the climate there, and temperatures in the interior can vary from as much as 80 below zero to as high as 100 degrees above zero, with winds frequently exceeding 100 knots in coastal areas. The Arctic zone is characterized by a mean annual temperature of between 10 and 20 degrees. Extreme lows at Barter Island can be as low as 59 below, and storms can produce high winds as high as 70 knots. Another problem in this area is due to restricted visibility due to blowing snow, fog, and whiteout conditions, which severely restrict aircraft operations. In the Arctic waters, with regard to barge transportation, of course, ice is a feature most of the year. Even during the limited open water season, broken and decaying ice is common in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and obviously can complicate vessel transportation. Ice and cold are also a factor in the transition in maritime zones. Cook Inlet frequently experiences sea ice in the winter. In fact, if it weren't for the very high tides in Cook Inlet, most of Upper Cook Inlet would be landlocked for most of the year. These very challenging climatic conditions limit the transportation, distribution, and storage options for Alaska, for diesel fuel in the state of Alaska. With regard to the question of economics, the costs associated, as we've heard today, are with complying with a low sulfur diesel requirement would be very, very high. MAPCO alone has estimated that it would require an investment. Because this low sulfur diesel must be segregated from the non-road diesel, which is a much larger percentage of the market, separate distribution, storage, and delivery systems would have to be installed. It's estimated that there are approximately 80 tank farms located throughout the state, many of them in extremely remote areas. Without the exemption, these locations would be required to construct and maintain separate facilities. In conclusion, AOGA commends EPA for the thorough analysis that it's done to date over the past 4 to 6 years of all the factors leading to the temporary exemptions which have been put into place over that period of time. And we encourage EPA to consider the comments that have been submitted during this last round of rulemaking and rightly conclude that a permanent exemption is appropriate for the state of Alaska. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We'll take a brief, Eddie, and may I resume and determine.
At 10:30, we're called back to order. Thank you, Marilyn Crockett. I did want to point out that the Alaska Oil and Gas Association has gone way, way out of their way to facilitate this meeting for me and to contact you folks, and I wanted to give them special recognition, and I appreciate the job that they're doing on behalf of Alaska Industries. And hope that you folks would recognize that and thank them. Next, we would have Petro Marine, Mr. Bill Sheffister.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Sheffister. I work for Petro Marine Services, which is an Alaskan fuel marketing distribution company. And I'd like to say that we support the petition by the state of Alaska for a permanent exemption from the requirement to limit motor fuel diesel to no more than 0.05% sulfur by weight. Petromarine Services is an Alaskan-owned and operated fuel marketing and distribution company We serve 16 communities in Alaska, many of which are isolated coastal communities not connected by roadways. The vast majority of the product we sold is for vessels, for heating oil consumption, and other non-road users. Highway diesel fuel sales amount to less than 2% of our total sales volume. If low-sulfur diesel were mandated for highway use in communities that we serve, we would have to segregate it from the moment it's purchased and throughout the transportation and the distribution network. All of the fuel that we purchase for sale is moved via tank barge to our fuel plants. Providing segregation for small volumes of low-sulfur diesel would greatly increase the cost per gallon and limit the flexibility and efficiency of our barging logistics. At our tank farms, we have nearly completed upgrading all facilities to meet the Open 90 requirements for impermeable liners and other improvements. It would be very costly to go back into those facilities now to add new tanks to provide segregated storage for this low-sulfur diesel. Ultimately, the end users will bear the cost of this requirement. In addition to the added cost of segregation, all low-sulfur fuel would have to be imported to Alaska because no Alaska refiner currently produces this product. Normal supply routes would be disrupted in order to get low-sulfur diesel from the West Coast refiners. A great deal of other fuel that we purchase in Alaska would also have to be purchased outside the state because the tank barges would not travel such distances to supply points simply to lift small volumes of low-sulfur diesel. As a consequence, a significant portion of our annual fuel volume would be purchased off the West Coast, thereby displacing Alaskan fuels, which would otherwise serve the local market. All of this displaced fuel would be replaced with fuel carrying as much as 15 cents per gallon added freight charges due to the longer hauling distances. All of this seems an extraordinary disruption of the market and an inflation of the price to accommodate a product with relatively low sales volume statewide. The stated purpose of the Clean Air Act requirement for low-sulfur diesel is to address health concerns associated with airborne particulate. Alaskans rarely seem to agree on any subject, but there appears to be a consensus that no general health problem exists here that could be corrected by this program. As stated in the state's petition to EPA, changing the motor vehicle diesel fuel requirement to low-sulfur diesel would remove an insignificant amount of particulate matter from the air at an unacceptably high cost-benefit ratio. Compliance with the low-sulfur requirements is clearly unreasonable in consideration of the unique fuel supply economics in Alaska. And we urge your continued support of the permanent exemption for all of Alaska. In addition to the prepared comments that I've had based on having listened to some of the earlier testimony, I would like to also suggest that we allow the marketplace to sort of solve this problem for us. I'm a great believer in the flexibility and the ability of the marketplace to adapt to change situations. And it seems to me that if the engine manufacturers are being forced to build an engine that needs low sulfur fuel, rather than have EPA mandate that we change the whole system of fuel supply in Alaska to accommodate those engines, it seems to me that it'd be up to the engine manufacturers to just simply state that their specification for their engines requires low sulfur diesel fuel, and that they would void the warranty. Anybody who didn't use it would void the warranty, and we could let the marketplace slowly and through an evolutionary process adopt to supply that, because there is low sulfur fuel brought into Alaska. Low sulfur fuel is available, but to mandate a complete change of our fuel system for the whole state of Alaska to simply accommodate these engines and then only in the highway areas just does not make any sense to me.
Thank you. Ms. Stewart, are you still online there? Lori?
Yes, I am.
You are going to be online until what time?
We'll stay on for quite a while, I think, through the mobile source section and probably part of the stationary source discussion.
If you had a time that you could stay on, I would try to tailor and maybe condense the rest of the hearing to satisfy your time limitations.
I think it would be helpful if we could probably stay on until 3:30 our time, which I guess would be 11:30.
Okay, I will suggest, and I will try to condense things to that point. We have some questions that popped up during the break, and one question was, how do you guys handle Mexico? We've got one road between Alaska and Canada, and yet Mexico has free access back and forth, and how does that work with the low sulfur diesels and their considerations?
I don't know. We'd have to check into that. I've not heard anything in that regard.
Okay. Is Mexico in a low sulfur diesel situation?
They are not in a low sulfur diesel. I'm not sure what their diesel sulfur requirements are.
Hmm. Okay.
We'd have to check it. We'll check into that.
If you could let me know, I would appreciate that.
Sure.
Do you have any follow-up, Mr. Shepister?
No, I had nothing else. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
You talked about the dollar amount. Do you have any idea what the dollar amount would be on your conversion? Any guess at all?
It depends so much on the volumes and where it is that it's very hard to say. I could suggest, from our experience in building storage facilities, I think we've had it's been as low as a dollar a gallon to as high as $4 a gallon. Sometimes we bring in old tanks and put them in, but with the new regulations for tanks and spill prevention, the price is higher than it used to be, and I would think it's more between $3 and $4 a gallon.
Can you give
to build
me
the storage?
Can you give me an approximate price of what? Are there zones within the state where it's more for the further out you are? Or?
I don't have costs and divided into zones. Obviously, the more rural construction is more expensive.
Okay.
Particularly because you've got the mobilization costs, and you're also typically building small storage facilities where the economics of scale don't work.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to move on into some refiners. We have Jeff Cook from MAPCO is signed up to testify. We've got just an hour, a little bit less than an hour, so we're going to move along fairly quickly. If it's all right with you, Ms. Stewart, we would probably begin approaching both mobile and stationary testimony to kind of give you an opportunity to hear both sides from the same refiner, if that would be all right with you.
Yes, that would be fine. Thank you.
If you'd identify yourself, sir.
Yes, my name is Jeff Cook. I'm Vice President of External Affairs for MAPCO Alaska Petroleum, situated at 1150 H&H Lane in North Pole, Alaska, and we're now part of the Williams family of companies. MAPCO Alaska Petroleum is here to clearly state our support for the full, final, and permanent exemption for Alaska from the sulfur requirements of the Clean Air Act that apply to diesel use for highway purposes. As has been stated, the current exemption expires on October 1st. Nothing has changed since 1993 when the state first requested a waiver for sulfur in highway diesel that would indicate any other course of action. In fact, continued study and review during the two temporary exemptions since that time have reinforced the desirability and need for the permanent exemption, and in April of 1998, EPA published its intent to issue a permanent exemption. The committee has already heard the many reasons to support the permanent exemption. You have been told of the negative economic consequences that clearly outweigh any benefit from enforcing the sulfur requirements for highway diesel. Not granting the exemption would potentially require the importation of most, if not all, highway diesel. It would again require dyeing of non-highway diesel, which accounts for 95% of daily diesel use in Alaska. The separate tankage and other logistical requirements would pose an undue burden in rural areas of Alaska where they have the least competition, and these are the areas of Alaska that can least afford increased prices of fuel costs. MAPCO urges this committee to use all means possible to encourage EPA to promptly issue the full and final exemption. We also ask that you request DEC and the governor write letters, make calls, and take other appropriate measures to urge EPA to grant the full and final exemption. And we have heard, I think Lori Stewart addressed this issue, the fact that we get a
permanent exemption does not mean that they could not revoke or rescind that if engine requirements or other situations so dictated in the future. And we hear a lot of comments about what likely might happen, but until all these issues can be quantified, it seems to make the most sense to grant the permanent exemption with the understanding, and they've stated it, that it could rescind. Failure to receive this exemption as we near our fall and winter season could result in an emergency situation. Fuel would not be available to deliver foodstuffs, medical supplies, gasoline supplies, and other commodities necessary for the health and safety of all Alaskans. We appreciate your concern with this matter and request your prompt and comprehensive response in making sure EPA issues a full and final exemption. Really, in the next few days, we're up against a real time crunch here, because if that's not going to be issued and we have to have the low sulfur diesel, it just can't be done between now and October 1. It cannot be done to serve all the areas of the state. And we do stand ready to offer any other assistance we can to the end of getting this permanent exemption. And with that, I'll conclude and thank you, and be pleased to answer questions if there are any.
I would have a couple of questions. One would be on the cost estimate, if you have one. And then the other would be the availability on such short notice of low sulfur diesel coming up from lower 48 sources. Is that going to have the pourability that we need for usage in the cold weather extremes on the North Slope and in Alaska?
That's a question of cost. MAFCO estimates the cost to bring our refinery up to the capability of producing the low sulfur diesel would be $100 million, possibly more. And we continue to look at technology and other innovative ways to do that. But at this point, that's our estimate of the cost.
And that cost of $100 million, that does not include distribution or dual tankage in areas?
No, that simply is our cost at the refinery to be able to make that low sulfur diesel. And as to the question of availability, it would be very tough with this short notice to have the segregated tankage you would need to get the product in and get it distributed in the state. And again, to have the specifications that would work in the Arctic, and there's some just
would you feel that you would be able to testify right now on what happens to diesel engines if they don't have the diesel that works in the lower temperatures?
I personally am not. There's others here from MAPCO that are a little more involved, a little more aware of and knowledgeable about that issue.
Mr. Cochran, would you come forward and introduce yourself and tell me what happens if we use warm weather diesel up here?
Sure. My name is Ron Cochran. I work for MAPCO Alaska Petroleum Inc. now, Williams Energy Services Company. Your question has to do with the pour point and the cloud point of the diesel fuel that's required in the state. As you heard testimony today from others that our climatology, we wind up with temperatures minus 60, minus 70, sometimes below that. The specifications that we manufacture to and other in-state refiners manufacture to is for a minus 60 degree Fahrenheit pour point and cloud point. Cloud point is that point in time where the paraffin crystals that are start to form in the fuel. When that happens, the fuel doesn't flow properly. When it goes through the filtering system, the crystals will plug off the filters on the fuel system, and the engine will cease operation.
That would be for both mobile and stationary sources, is that correct?
Yeah, for any piece of equipment that operates in an Arctic environment, you have to have that low pour characteristic to it, or it won't work. The pour point, physically, if you take that cup sitting on your table, put the fuel in it, and chill it down to minus 61 degrees, our fuel won't pour. It will pour at minus 60, as will the other refiners in the state. That's how we make it to that point. Now, obviously, if it sets up like that, it won't work in a motor.
So it's not just a simple question of bringing low-sulfur diesel into the state of Alaska from outside sources. We have to have a special kind of low-sulfur diesel that maybe is not produced out there.
Yeah, across the entire U.S., there's standards that set up by the American Standard Testing Methods materials. The ASTM publishes data that's on historic basis. I think they go back over 100 years, and some of this data for temperatures recorded within areas, and they determine by month, by area of the country, including Alaska, which is broken into, I believe, four sections, what the typical temperatures are during those months of the year, and they suggest that there's a 10th percentile mean that you'll 90% of the time you'll be within this, only 10% of the time you would exceed this temperature, that says you need to make a fuel of a certain characteristic and quality. And that, again, goes by months. And when we get into our colder Arctic months, they require a minus 60 up here to operate. If it doesn't meet that, it doesn't work.
And a very short answer, if you can, is that available from sources, refineries outside, or does that include a different process?
Well, the refineries in the lower 48, because they're in a different temperate zone, they don't manufacture to a minus 60. I don't know any place that manufactures to a minus 60 cloud point on the fuel. I'm just not aware of any. I buy a lot of fuel.
So in your estimation, it is not a simple a matter just to bring up low sulfur fuel.
No, and this was investigated by the task force. Again, if you go back to my earlier testimony, I thought, well, Canada has temperatures that are similar to ours, and maybe we can go there to find it, but that was not the case. When it comes to having the low pore fuel, they are actually in a deficit position. They don't have enough of it in their own areas that they sure wouldn't have enough to export.
Thank you. Representative Ryan, you had a question of Mr. Cochran or Mr. Cook.
About 15 years ago in Fairbanks, we had a problem with some number two diesel. A lot of homes it got real cold and furnaces were going out and so forth, the same kind of thing.
Absolutely. There was a group of folks who decided that they could modify chemically the pore point of the fuel, and you can do certain tricks chemically. You could add some what are called pore point depressants, and it will modify the flow characteristics. What it'll do is the paraffin crystals that form are different dimensions and sizes. Some of them are great big, some are quite small. If they're great big, it stops flowing early. The smaller paraffin, they'll flow at a colder rate. You can break down the great big ones and make the fuel flow at a lower temperature, but they're still present, and you have to be real conscientious of viscosity, the rate that the fuel flows. And even though you might make it continue to flow, it may not flow at the proper rate, and that will cause improper atomization when you're going through the flame retention burners on heating systems. It doesn't atomize properly. It just goes kind of kersplat against the back wall rather than having a flame and heat that's coming out there. It'll puddle up, and eventually you'll get into a smoking condition and potentially even burn a house down.
One further question. The aircraft industry has dealt with this for many years, the wide-cut fuels, the kerosene's added to keep the viscosity at the temperatures they operate at, altitude and so forth. Would any of that aircraft fuel meet their low-sulfur specifications that could perhaps be imported, or is that a different breed of cat?
It is a different breed of cat, and again, that was examined closely by the task force. It was looked at even as an area to step up into, can we make low sulfur now or intermediate sulfur. The specification for jet fuel, which is the product you're talking about, has a freeze point. Typically, I think this airport out here requires ASTM 1655 with a minus 50 freeze point on it, not a minus 60 like it's being used on the Arctic, et cetera. In addition to which, the sulfur specifications on jet fuel are 0.3, whereas on highway diesel we're looking at 0.05, considerable difference. So if the jet fuel may not meet the requirements of the pore across the state, it might meet it for some areas of the state, but it isn't manufactured to meet the low sulfur requirements for highway diesel, so why mandate that use when it doesn't meet the requirements of the existing Clean Air Act law?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Cook, did you want to apologize for bringing Mr. Cochran up in the middle of your testimony?
No, I was done.
Would,
Okay. Very good.
You asked me a question, boy. I'm glad you brought them up.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody else that would like to come forward and talk about? Yes, sir. If you'd identify yourself.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ron Knoll. I'm Vice President and General Counsel for Tesoro Alaska Petroleum Company. And, Mr. Chairman, I know you're well familiar with Tesoro, but for the record, I would like to state that Tesoro Alaska owns and operates a full slate of refinery at Nikiski, Alaska. The capacity of that refinery is 72,000 barrels a day. And we distribute and sell petroleum products, thank you, throughout the, thankfully, I feel better than I sound.
Can the folks in the back here, Mr. Knoll? Okay, thank you.
Throughout the state of Alaska, we also sell our products on the west coast of the United States and in the Russian Far East. Tesoro appreciates the opportunity to appear before your committee today, and would like to state that I'm filling in for President Steve Wormington, who would like to have been here, but finds himself in Melbourne, Australia this week. So he asked me to sit in for him, and I will do the best I can in that capacity. My goal is to express for the committee and perhaps clarify Tesoro's position concerning low-sulfur diesel fuel for mobile sources or on-road uses in the state of Alaska. First, Tesoro continues to support, we have consistently supported a permanent exemption for the state of Alaska as to the required use of low-sulfur diesel fuel for on-road purposes. We've heard nothing in the past, we've heard nothing today that would change, cause us to change that position. However, we have started to look at some contingency plans of how we would handle a situation in the event a long-term exemption is not issued, or perhaps the EPA decided not to extend the present temporary exemption beyond the expiration date of October 1. 1998. First, it would be Tesoro's goal to meet its customers' requirements, and of course we would comply with any government regulations relative to the use of low sulfur diesel, whatever they may turn out to be. We've had some opportunity to change, for our situation to change during the past year or so. And Mr. Chairman, this has come about as a result of, say, starting from about a year ago. At that time, our refinery, we were running in terms of crude oil, about 85% ANS crude and about 15%, sometimes a little bit more, of Cook Inlet crude. Now, as you know, the Cook Inlet crude, as we refer to as a sweet crude, meaning it is inherently low in sulfur. For about the past year, Tesoro has been able to purchase all of the Cook Inlet production. And right now, that in round numbers is about 31,000 barrels a day. And we presently are processing, in addition to the Cook Inlet, about the same amount of ANS crude, which for the most part we're purchasing from the state of Alaska and from royalty oil from the state. So we're running about 50-50 ANS and Cook Inlet crude. Up to this point, we've made no attempts to segregate the crudes as they come in for processing. Essentially, are commingled and run together. Now, what we've done recently is we've looked into the possibility of what refinery folks call batch running, in other words, segregating and running the Cook Inlet crude by itself. And what our people have concluded is that with some reasonably minor revisions of operating procedures, in addition probably of some tankage at the refinery, that in a fairly short period of time, Tesoro could produce about 100,000 barrels per month of low sulfur diesel at Nikiski. Now we've heard different numbers. We use the number of 5% of the total demand for diesel fuel in the state needed for on-road purposes, And I'm not sure if that figure is accurate. I've heard other figures up to 11%, but it's somewhere in there, probably 5 to 10%. That 100,000 barrels per month, just in terms of volume, would probably more than meet that demand. This is not a complete answer to this problem. Due to transportation, logistics, and tankage restraints, for example, diesel deliveries, low sulfur diesel at different locations, say, for example, deliveries by means of our pipeline to the Anchorage terminal, would have to be either low sulfur or high sulfur diesel. We have no ability at this time to segregate these grades at the terminals. We have done some preliminary analysis of additional costs to provide this product, and that's just to the point of what I've just described. I don't know exactly what that number is, but I'm told that it may approach 11 cents a gallon, so somewhere around that number. We would also like to express, as we have in recent months concerning gasoline pricing, that there is not necessarily a direct correlation between any increased cost of production and the price that the consumer will ultimately pay. The price will be determined in the marketplace, could result in the customer absorbing some or perhaps none of any increased cost as far as Tesoro is concerned. Historically, increased costs of production have not been borne totally by the customer. We have looked somewhat at some of the other U.S. market areas where low sulfur diesel has been mandated, and it appears, and again, we may be comparing apples and oranges in some cases there, but overall in the lower 48, it looks like the increase in price of low sulfur diesel over high sulfur diesel has been in the range of 2 to 3 cents a gallon. In summary, Mr. Chairman, Tesoro's goal will be, as always, to meet the requirements of its customers and to comply with government regulations. We can produce this amount of low sulfur diesel, and we could do that in a fairly short period of time. The cost, which would be not insignificant, but would not be anything horrendous that we can see. I appreciate the opportunity to put this testimony on the record and perhaps clarify our position for the committee. And if you'll just keep in mind I'm a lawyer, not an engineer, I'd be glad to try to answer questions that you or the other members of the committee may have.
I would have a question, Mr. Noel.
Yes.
You indicated that you could produce low sulfur diesel.
Yes.
Can you produce enough for the entire state? Stationary and mobile sources?
No. Not stationary and mobile sources. Immediately what we could produce is about 100,000 barrels a month, and that would be, I think we're comfortable in saying that would, just in terms of volume, now not distribution, but volume, that would satisfy the present requirements for on-road diesel for mobile sources.
So then you would then be in a position to supply low sulfur diesel for those folks that would want low sulfur diesel, without, regardless of whether there was the exemption or not, so that if we got the exemption, a permanent exemption, Tesoro could supply low sulfur diesel for the needs of the higher technology diesel engines that Mr. Mandel was talking about.
That's correct.
And we would then solve the problem of the low pourability with that diesel, is that correct?
That's correct.
And that would then, we would not then have to import low sulfur diesel that we cannot get with the pourability that was mentioned earlier by Mr. Cochran and Mr. Cook.
That's also correct, Mr. Chairman.
So it is still your position, Tesoro's position, that the exemption should be allowed and the exemption would go forward, and if that is the case, you will supply low sulfur diesel for those individuals that need it with the new technology of diesel engines.
We would be able to supply that product to meet customer demands within the constraints that I've described. Yes, sir.
Yes, but not within the stationary. You couldn't meet all the total stationary requirements for low sulfur low-temperature diesel.
No, sir. What I was describing was just an attempt at a partial solution to the immediate problem for the on-road diesel.
Thank you, because I think what we've done then is we've now established that we can produce low-sulfur diesel to take care of the folks that need it, and we can continue to supply the diesel that's portable for the cold temperature and for the folks that don't require the low-sulfur diesel.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Questions, Representative Ryan.
Good morning, Ryan.
That's right.
Mr. Noll and I have a relationship back many years ago. He represented me one time, very admirably, too. The cost factor, it kind of intrigues me. Your cost of production would be perhaps somewhere around between 5 and 10 cents or 11 cents a gallon. We're not talking about distribution. You've mentioned additional costs on your pipeline for transportation. You're expected to recover your cost of operation and to be profitable if you're going to stay in business. So we're talking about adding a considerable expense here to distribution, transportation, over and above the top, the cost of production, and then a reasonable margin to ensure the viability of your company. So would I be too far to say perhaps a quarter of a gallon, a quarter of a gallon? Would that be a little high? Or what I'm leading to is basically we're looking at the increased cost of goods and services to the people of Alaska. I'm being mandated to use this because the people who have to buy your fuel are going to want to have to pass those costs on. And part of their operational aspect is usually a percentage figured in for overhead and profit in addition to cost. So you see how this exponentially gets, and one of the factors on the decision on the permit is the economic consequences. So I'm seeing something build here, even though you can provide this. At what cost are the people of Alaska going to have to pay to meet this mandate, and is it going to be a reasonable cost?
Yeah, Mr. Ryan, I think the first of all, that's a very rough number that I used, and I'm not sure all the things that the guys put in that number. One thing was additional tankage we needed at the refinery and some capitalized costs there, but our point was that we were describing a scenario where we would be the state would be mandated to use low-sulfur diesel for on-road purposes, and our main point there was, regardless of what our cost would be, that the cost to the consumer would be a function of whatever the marketplace, how the marketplace responded. So it's really pretty difficult to make a correlation between our cost and some margin that the customer necessarily would pay. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Freeman.
Thank you, Chairman Hodgins. Good morning, Chairman Hodgins, members of the committee. My name is Ken Freeman, Executive Director of the Resource Development Council. And for the sake of time and because many of the points I will cover have already been addressed today, I'll keep my comments brief. RDC strongly supports a permanent exemption for Alaska by the EPA from the diesel fuel sulfur requirement. RDC believes Alaska's unique circumstances certainly justify exemption from the national requirement. As many of you know, RDC is a nonprofit, membership-funded trade organization consisting of private firms from all resource sectors, business associations, labor unions, native corporations, local governments, and thousands of individuals. RDC's purpose is to encourage a strong, diversified private sector in Alaska and expand the state's economic base through the responsible development of our natural resources. The status of the exemption affects many of our urban and rural members. As you've already heard today, no area of Alaska violates the National Ambient Air Quality Emission Standards. Temperature inversions, not motor vehicle emissions, are the primary cause of air quality matters in the state. And for Alaska, of course, the costs associated with low-sulfur diesel compliance are very high. One of the biggest problems that you're all aware of is lack of infrastructure in rural Alaska, and if Alaska is required to use low sulfur diesel, importation, storage, and distribution costs will increase. So without significant improvements to human health and the environment, these additional costs do seem unreasonable. Again, RDC does strongly encourage the EPA to permanently exempt Alaska from the low sulfur diesel fuel requirement. I think the bottom line is that we shouldn't lose the exemption because of engine manufacturing issues, but rather should gain the exemption because of the lack of air quality degradation and economic considerations. And I wanted to add as well that I really appreciate the committee addressing this issue today. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Freeman? Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to come forward at this time? We have about 15 more minutes because I'd like to wrap up and then let Ms. Stewart wrap up. Yes, sir?
If you'd, Walter Gore with PetroStar.
If you'd announce that into the microphone system for the record. And
my name is Walter Gore. I'm a manager for government compliance and safety with PetroStar Incorporated. I'm here to take the place of my CEO, Steve Lewis, who couldn't make it. PetroStar, as some of you know, is a Alaskan native-owned corporation with refineries in North Pole and Valdez, Alaska. We distribute diesel and home heating fuel, aviation fuels in the interior. We have distribution facilities in Dutch and Kodiak, and we also deliver to the military in Anchorage. We've been part of the sulfur debate since 1991 and have consistently supported the governor's petition and still support that position. We have looked into conventional means to produce low sulfur fuel, and as Jeff Cook said, they're very expensive. A small unit for us would run $50 to $60 million, and it, given the size of the market, it's certainly not worthwhile to do that. The purpose here is today is just to lend our support for the governor's permanent exemption for the low sulfur fuel use in the state of Alaska. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Do you have any questions? Would it be safe to say that whoever, because of the low market, whoever puts in the first low sulfur unit will have a monopoly on the market in Alaska because it's others will not have there's not enough market there or market share to convert the other two refineries?
I think that would be fair. However, in Tesoro's case, if they were to supply that fuel, then the other two refineries probably would not. And that's based on their use of their cook inlet crude. It's very low in sulfur, and their processing units can probably produce a straight run diesel that is low in sulfur.
Okay. So thank you very much. Somebody else would like to come forward and identify yourself, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Good morning. For the record, my name is Jim Pfeiffer, and I'm an environmental engineer for Municipal Light and Power, 1200 East 1st Avenue, Anchorage. I'm speaking to you today on behalf of the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association, or ARECA, as the incoming chair of ARECA's Environmental Regulations Committee. The Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association is a trade organization that represents the electric cooperative and publicly owned utilities that generate and deliver 95% of the electric power used in the state of Alaska. Our members vary in size considerably from 70,000 customers down to 70 customers. The operating environments for our member utilities vary considerably from the large interconnected rail belt utilities to the bush utilities, where a handful of employees face constant physical, logistical, and economic challenges just to keep the lights on. I should say also that bush utilities
have a near total dependence on stationary diesel power generation. For a number of reasons, ARECA wholeheartedly supports a permanent exemption from low sulfur highway diesel fuel. Permanent exemption from the mandate for low sulfur highway diesel fuel. One of the points being, for any electric utility, fuels are the largest component of expense, and for many ARECA utilities, fuel choices are limited and by any measures costly. The fuels market in Alaska would be significantly disrupted if a permanent exemption is not granted. The economic impact would hit Bush communities, Bush utilities, and the communities they serve the hardest. Another reason is that Alaska refiners and their employees are good customers of ARECA utilities. The hardships that refiners feel as a lack of an exemption will have trickle-down effects to a number of businesses, including electric utilities. A reason which has been brought up a number of times by other commenters is that rural Alaska already has a fuel storage tank problem. Actually, it's one of the things that the ARECA Environmental Regulations Committee has been trying to come to grips with, and there are no easy solutions. And the lack of an exemption will only make a bad situation worse. Final point I'd like to make is that technical problems associated with the new reciprocating engine designs will not be an issue in Alaska for many years. And for people who are struggling to get through the winter of 98, they should not be strapped with problems which might show up in the year 2004 and beyond. That concludes my comments.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions on the logistics of the stationary electrical generation sources in the bush. If we go to a low sulfur situation that does not, and we cannot get a product on the short notice that has the pourability for combustion in the extreme cold environments, how would they handle that in the bush communities? Do they store the fuel inside the houses? Do they store the fuel inside warm sheds for the electrical? What is the?
No, the most fuel farms in rural Alaska are outside in the cold, and you know, a lot of times in a village electric situation, the generating plant that uses fuel also sets the same tank supplies to school, heating, those sorts of things. So you have a lot of commingled sort of tank storage there. To address the issues of fuel delivery and that sort of thing in western Alaska and rural Alaska would be difficult for me if there were a were not an exemption. I'm sure it would have an impact out there. They'd still be able to get fuel, and they'd be able to get fuel of the quality they need. It would just cost a lot more.
Well, let me ask you this question, or restate it possibly. If you have a village that is operated by a stationary diesel generator, and if the only diesel they can get is low sulfur that does not have the capability of the pourability in colder weather, and that diesel, that generator does not work, are those people put at risk to extreme cold, lack of power, and personal injury?
Very definitely.
So in order for the villages to comply with this, they're going to have either the diesel, the low sulfur diesel, with the pourability of the extreme cold conditions, or else they're going to have to warm and keep the diesel heated to a temperature that will allow it to go through the combustion. Would that be correct?
Well, that assumes that the stationary diesel engines are the sulfur, the fuel sulfur limits on stationary diesel engines are limited typically by air quality control permits to operate, which vary from site to site depending on local ambient conditions and source conditions. Provided that there's still a market available out there for high sulfur fuel or higher sulfur fuel, higher than 0.05, then that fuel should be available to Bush Utilities.
Okay. Yeah, that. Thank you very much. Anybody else care to offer a little bit of testimony here at this point? My apologies for combining the stationary and actually condensing down this agenda.